coming up on Weekend America.
Treasure Williams was feeling good after Obama was sworn in. Then she tuned into the R&B station, heard the lyrics, and felt different.
It was maybe 2 days after the inauguration, and I almost had to pull over because I just thought, wouldn't this all stop now?
I'm John Moe. A drive-thru was completely different for Charlie's in-laws, which made it kind of weird for Charlie to be in the car with them.
In my observations of like a Chinese meal, that there are usually fist fights that break out when the bill comes. And I wasn't about to get in one of these altercations with my in-laws.
And competitive powerlifting sure is different from being a judge, but Faith adjusted.
The nails are gone and I got the suit on by myself. That means the suit's too big.
Weekend America, the show that always was a little bit different, after the news.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe in St. Paul, where it's supposed to be 33 today. 33! We have not had it above freezing in all of 2009, so we're kind of excited. The snow will melt a little, then the temperature will drop overnight, the water will freeze, and tomorrow will be terrifying. But for today, yay! Also for today, boo. It's the final Weekend America. We're choosing to observe that by doing what we think matters most, bringing you more great stories on love, the Rolling Stones, powerlifting, the Super Bowl, and a story about stories. Also, robots. What are you doing this weekend?
This weekend we'll be going to a cheerleading competition on Saturday and watching the game on Sunday.
We will be watching the Super Bowl.
I'm probably going to watch the Super Bowl.
It's the Super Bowl this weekend? I'm not a football fan, I'm sorry. I've been watching the Australian Open.
This weekend, I'm waking up like at 6 o'clock in the morning. Then I got to get dressed because I got to go to work. And a lot of people like to come to McDonald's on Sunday.
I'm going
to
do some homework. I'm going to sleep a lot. And I might write some poetry.
I want to hear the poetry that she writes while she's asleep. Those voices came from Minneapolis and Detroit. Well, the election cycle is finally complete and President Obama is hard at work. But now is when all that rhetoric that we heard all through the campaign is actually put to the test. Obama and company promised change, but now have to, you know, change things. Now they have to decide what matters. Since last September, Weekend America has been asking writers and thinkers for their take on what matters to them, what should matter to all of us during this time of political change. We called the series Conversations with America, and now that a new administration is underway, we wanted to get three of those contributors together to ask each other some questions. Lindsay O'Connor is a writer based in Colorado, Brian Turner is a poet and Iraq war veteran in Fresno, and Treasure Williams is a poet and educator in Memphis. The conversation starts with Lindsay.
My point in my original essay was that voting can be an act of faith. And so, of course, the specifics have changed, you know, now that we have a new administration. And even for those who did not vote for Obama, I think it is really important to strive to continue to do that, whether you are nervous, because some of the policy decisions that are happening are frankly making a lot of evangelical Christians very concerned. Or if you're just filled with hope, I think it's important that all of us try to make choices where what we say we believe is integrated into our life.
This is Brian Turner. I'm in Fresno, California. I was in the U.S. Army as an infantry team leader in Iraq for a year, and I'm currently a poet. I think the way is definitely forward, and I'm very hopeful. But at the same time, part of the process of moving forward is to be responsible and accountable for what we have done. We did a raid near Balad, which is north of Baghdad, and we had some gentlemen. We busted into their house. We dragged them out into this animal stall, flexed cuffed them with the plastic handcuffs, blindfolded them, held them out there for hours while we were trying to figure out if these were the people we were supposed to get. And eventually, it came down that these weren't the right people. We apologized, took the stuff off of them, let them go back into their house. I later tried to think, you know, what would it be like if I was one of them, you know? And there are other instances like that from my own personal experience when I was in Iraq, where torture is one issue, for example, needs to be prosecuted. And I think there needs to be a gradation of scale, depending on how much power you had. Maybe there need to be trials in The Hague.
My name is Treasure Williams, and I live in Memphis, but I work in Holly Springs, Mississippi, where I am an instructor of English at Rust College. And, you know, when you think that there are American personnel that should be tried at The Hague, the first thing I think is you're going to get in a file for that, Brian. You're going to be watched
yeah.
for that.
Yeah, sure.
The second thing I think is, you know, my husband is a big sci-fi fantasy guy. And one of the tropes, one of the reoccurring ideas that I love about sci-fi is this idea that in the future, all the worlds will participate in taking care of the universe, and that you will see the beings from E.T. and the beings from Beta 7 all standing, passing legislation to take care of the universe. Now, when I think of the UN, that's what I always hope is going to happen. I hope I'm going to turn on C-SPAN and I'm going to see someone in a Bantu outfit and an American with a cowboy hat, and we're all going to work together and share power. But I would love to see us live out our faith, Lindsay, by authentically sharing power and treating other cultures as if they are humans on this planet.
This is getting on a different subject, but I was just wondering, considering the election, the result of the election, has it affected your writing at all? Treasure, I know you write poetry, and has it affected the way you approach the page now?
I don't think it's affected the way I approach the page. I had a family member ask me to write a poem about Barack Obama, and he said, "I'm sure you're just fairly gushing with ideas." And I have been resistant. I think I'm just gestating that. I'm just letting that kind of marinate.
Has it for you, Brian? Has it changed your writing?
I don't know. You know, it's easy for me to ask the question to you two, but for myself, it's a difficult question as well.
Yeah, back at you. I wouldn't say it's changed my writing so much as it's caused. I love your word, treasure marinate. That's so great. We stew in our own thoughts and let it sink in deep.
Right.
But in my writing, I'm finally writing about an experience I had where I was in a coma and faced end-of-life issues and had to grapple with what I really believed about all that. So I'm writing about that in a deeper way maybe than before. Brian, I have a question.
Yes.
You wrote in your piece about watching that man go through, the Iraqi go through the checkpoint and then having his friend's blood on his hands, and he came to you for help and you had to turn him away. How did you feel right in that moment when you looked at that man and then he drove off?
I felt ashamed. I felt really deeply ashamed. And I couldn't really, there was nothing more I could do at that moment.
Has it haunted you?
Well, it does. The hard part is, it's not just me that was standing at the gate refusing that person help.
It was your country.
I had the American flag on my shoulder.
Yeah.
And we refused that person help.
Yeah.
And we have responsibility to these people. If people back here don't feel a responsibility to it, to me it seems like a fundamental, like, psychic disconnect. And there's a real problem with that.
Can I share a story of what you just said, how that touches me personally, and something that you said in your essay? You said, "We have a responsibility to help the millions of Iraqis fleeing the war as refugees." And after I did my essay, I left and went to Thailand for the first time in my life, and I went to Burma. I had never been in a refugee camp. So it's not just this issue that you raised of Iraqi refugees, but that there is a broader world out there than so many of us in our small communities and our small daily lives sometimes give notice to. And you also talked about, just because we're not talking about the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq doesn't mean that it goes away. And I saw that in this refugee camp, that the issue of what's happening to some Burmese refugees that are fleeing their country because of oppression and pouring into Thailand, into these refugee camps, hoping someday to go back to Burma, my eyes were opened in a way that they never had been before on a couple of things, that we have such incredible freedom, freedom of our government, freedom to worship, freedom to have enough food to eat on a daily basis. And I looked at these people, 7,000 people stacked together, like one man told me, like animals in a zoo. And that takes me back to faith, because I think the greatest thing that we should be known by is how do we love, you know? What is our compassion like?
Lindsay O'Connor is a writer based in Colorado. Iraq War veteran Brian Turner is a poet in Fresno, California, and poet Treasure Williams lives in Memphis, teaches at Rust College in Mississippi. You can find links to their original Conversations with America essays at weekendamerica.org. I've been thinking about humor and politics in two cases this week. First, Rod Blagojevich. He blows off his own impeachment trial to go on The View and other TV shows to insist on his own innocence. Then he shows up for the last day of his own trial, gives a long speech in his own defense, and then promptly gets thrown out of office. And I'm conflicted. I mean, it's inescapably funny. Come on, the hubris of it all, the brazenness of his alleged crimes, the oft-mocked hair coif, the wide-eyed blinking insistence on talking long after most people would have slinked away. Then again, it's not funny. Here's a guy who was running one of the largest states in our country accused of massive corruption. The system is broken. There are rats and asbestos in the house. And the nation is made more cynical. And that is serious. But here's what's funny. He doesn't get that. He was so separated from reality about the way you handle power or the way you handle scandal or hair care, that it makes you wonder how he got to be like that. And that brings me to the other humor-related situation from this week. Sidwell Friends, where Malia and Sasha Obama go to school, had a snow day this week after receiving really not all that much snow. And President Obama talked about that in a meeting with business leaders. "When it comes to the weather, folks in Washington don't seem to be able to handle things," he said. "We're going to have to apply some toughness to this town. As my children pointed out in Chicago, school is never canceled." And everyone laughed. And that laughter made me kind of nervous because it wasn't funny. He was making an observation, maybe trying to be kind of wry, but they laughed because he was the president. Wouldn't have happened if State Senator Obama had said it, or Mr. Obama, the community organizer. When you're a leader and people are laughing in your vicinity, it's a good idea to know why the laughter is taking place. Barack Obama is no Rod Blagojevich, certainly, but I have one hope. Mr. Biden, Mrs. Clinton, Mr. Emanuel, listen up. If your boss tells a joke and it isn't funny, please don't laugh.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week.
Where would you take someone who had never been to America before? Charlie decided to take his in-laws to a McDonald's drive-thru and a Tom Jones concert in Vegas. Ride along next on Weekend America. It's Weekend America from American Public Media. I'm John Moe. Happy Year of the Ox. According to the Chinese calendar, we just entered the new year a few days ago. Celebrations are in full swing this weekend in many Asian American communities across the country. It's traditionally a time to spend with family, which makes it bittersweet for Wendy Mock. She's lived in Los Angeles for 5 years, and her parents, Kenneth and Regina, live in Hong Kong, so they don't get to see each other all that much. But recently, Wendy and her husband, reporter Charlie Schroeder, got them to come visit. It was their first trip ever to America, and it only happened after years of nagging.
We made a DVD for them.
Oh, yeah.
It was called, like, Our Lives in America, or something like that. And we made, like, this highlight reel, and Wendy narrated it in Cantonese. And for some strange reason, I gave them a tour of our apartment building's garage.
Hondas are very popular cars. In our garage.
It worked. They came to see us. Television is very powerful. Far, we've been traveling far. I call my in-laws mommy and daddy.
Yeah, it's a Chinese thing. Don't ask.
Yeah. So mommy really loves old Hollywood movies. So I thought right off the bat that she would love to see where the celebrities live.
Oh, wow, look at this view out here, mommy. Look.
Yeah,
wow.
Really good view.
So we as we're driving around, she saw something caught her eye, and she asked me in Chinese, what's that?
There is a flag there.
Yeah, it doesn't mean a thing. Everybody has an American flag here.
And there's a house just sort of perched up on this hill, and it's this very stately place. And she thinks for a moment, well, this must be where, like, the president lives.
Because no one in Hong Kong would have a flag outside their apartment.
I mean, Wendy comments on this all the time. We drive across the country, and she'll be like, it's an American flag in every yard. It's amazing. And it is. It's kind of uncanny. I think Americans must be the most proud people ever.
Lionel Barrymore. You're not Lionel Barrymore?
Your mom's asleep again.
Yeah.
We're sort of winding up these roads or whatever. I'm like, look, Clark Gable. And I look in the rearview mirror and she's like, mommy's asleep. Every time that flag's unfurled, they come into America. You know, one of the big things when people travel for them is food. Like, what kind of food are they going to eat? Wendy's dad was a little concerned about some of the Western food, so we had a plan, the old standby.
Hi, welcome to McDonald's. I'll be with you 1 second.
Okay. McDonald's.
Go ahead and order whenever you're ready.
A number 3, no cheese, and a Coke with that.
And mommy is just like, what is going on?
She looked so puzzled when you started talking to a menu.
He said, buy me some hamburger in McDonald's. But he's still driving, so I don't know. What he's doing.
Fish burger with iced coffee.
This was the first time that they had ever gone through a drive-thru. In my observations of like a Chinese meal, that there are usually fist fights that break out when the bill comes. And I wasn't about to get in one of these altercations with my in-laws.
Hold on a sec. I don't know where my wallet is.
So I happened to hide my wallet in the trunk. Or nobody could find it.
Thank you, mommy. You didn't need to pay.
The moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie. That's amore.
Mommy and Daddy's one big, like, Western vacation was to Europe, like, 30 years ago. And they had a very, very romantic time in Venice when they went on the gondola. And they wanted to relive that experience. So we took them to Las Vegas, to the Venetian, to the indoor gondola, in the mall. With a singing gondolier who wants us to kiss under bridges. Which apparently is a no-no in Chinese culture.
You know, in Venice, it's tradition to kiss under the bridges for good luck.
Not in front of Chinese parents.
How many bridges are there?
14.
14, great.
Hey, my Chinese customers kiss under bridges.
Well, actually translate it to my mom is that, hey, look, you have to kiss when we go through under each bridge. And my mom, of course, said, oh, no. I've only seen my parents kissed once, and it was my dad give my mom a little peck on the cheek. We show affection through food.
Can I kiss now?
Yes, right under the bridge.
Don't look.
And, of course, they never kissed.
They didn't.
No, they didn't. know, Mom and Dad were here for 15 days. And we literally went to everywhere. We took them everywhere. We went to beaches. We went to canals.
Every museum in Los Angeles.
And gardens. And we went up to the mountains.
We even took Mommy to see her favorite singer of all time in Las Vegas.
Well, she's all you'd ever want. She's the kind I'd like to flaunt and take to dinner.
Tom Jones.
But she always knows her place. She's got style, she's got grace. She's a winner.
And look, Tom Jones at the Hollywood Theater, three rows from the stage.
Very near.
Yeah. So we'll be able to
really
see.
Expensive.
No, it's not expensive. Well, yeah, a little, but it's okay. It's okay.
My mom tried not to appear too excited.
But she demanded that we take her photograph outside with the poster.
I would like to say that it's great to be back once again at the MGM in Las Vegas.
She was really, really, really thrilled.
Oh, you know, just kind of bobbing her head, and I would say doing the white man's overbite, but.
And the lady is mine.
You know, when all was said and done, I wanted to find out from Mommy and Daddy, like, what they thought of everything. So I asked them. What was your favorite thing on the trip?
Oh, it's a very interesting in this city, you know. That no need to pay any money for the car park.
Why are you doing what? We went through a drive through, we saw Clark Gable's home, and the most interesting thing is free parking?
Yeah.
Whenever I travel or whenever somebody comes to the United States, I try to see the world through their eyes. For the most part, whenever I'm driving around, I just am going from point A to point B, and I don't appreciate what I see. But I think when they were here, I really appreciated all of the things that we have. That people here have tremendous freedoms and opportunities. And I think that that's one of the things that you might not always recognize if you just stay here, or if you're not, if you don't have another opinion or perspective to help you see what you have.
And you know what? Every time I park my car right before I do some grocery shopping, I think of my parents.
Yeah, and every time I have to pay for parking, I think that it's the most un-American act imaginable.
Yes, they'll all come to meet me on reaching. Smiling sweetly, it's good to touch the green, green grass of home. The old house is still standing, though the paint is cracked and dry. And there's that old oak tree that I used to play on.
Weekend America is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, KPCC Los Angeles, and KUOW Seattle, and is made possible in part by the University of Washington Foster School of Business Executive MBA Program.
When you've defined yourself as a judge, how do you redefine yourself as a power lifter? And when you've always rooted for the Cardinals, how do you make sense of success? Riddles, ahead on Weekend America. From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe, and it's time once more to listen to your weekend soundtrack. Our final weekend soundtrack comes from Susan Akers of Pendleton, Indiana, and her weekend soundtrack is by the Rolling Stones, Shattered. Susan, why is this your weekend soundtrack?
It just has the energy and excitement and sound of promise of fun behind it. I mean, right from Keith's intro and Charlie's drumming. It's a lot of fun to hear this song every time. Plus, it has some great memories for me from the late 70s.
Tell me about those memories.
Well, I was about 23 years old when this song came out. I rented a huge 40-acre plot of land with an old farmhouse on it. And I would have big parties out there. We'd play the Stones, and we'd play, you know, Steely Dan, and just a lot of great stuff. And we'd play the music on these big speakers out in the front yard, have volleyball games until late into the night.
So when you were living in this house, this big farmhouse in Indiana, who were you living with?
Well, my brother was there with me for a while, and also had a friend named Dixie, and it was wonderful. And then my brother, who I just dearly love, rest in peace, and I think of him every day, and I miss him, and he loved music so much, and so do I.
Tell me more about your brother.
Well, he was 2 years older than me, and he was very much a sports and music nut and very intelligent. But later on, when he hit puberty, he started having seizures. He had epilepsy, and he did all right for a long time. And then the medicine, in his case, lost its effectiveness. And by, I guess about 1980, he was having more trouble controlling his seizures, and he ended up dying early at the age of 27.
When you hear this song, how does it make you feel about your brother?
Oh, I just wish he were here, and I wish he could still be around to listen to great music with me and a lot of the cool music that I'm into now. Great music. My Morning Jacket. There's a lot of good stuff out there. Don't you know the crime rate's going up? I think I've had to be tough. In my life, I've lived in L.A. and Atlanta, Georgia, and I'm not a tough person, but I thought, you know, you have to be kind of tough sometimes to be on your own.
Susan Akers of Pendleton, Indiana, thank you.
Thank you very much. I really enjoy your program.
Susan Akers, that story launched me after we did that original interview on a weeks-long 70s-era Stones kick. I'm still not over it. Go through your catalog if you can. Wild Horses, are you kidding me? Miss You, Emotional Rescue even. Some great stuff, some weird stuff. Good stuff. Our entire archive of weekend soundtracks is available at weekendamerica.org. Take a tour through other people's stories, other people's weekends, other people's music. Those things will be up there indefinitely.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. This weekend, maybe even right now, Faith Ireland is in Seattle trying to lift 290 pounds. Faith is one of those people who make you feel like you should be doing more with your own life. First off, she's a member of the best women's masters powerlifting team in the country. Masters means over 40 years old. In 2 weeks, Faith and the rest of her team will defend their title at the USA Powerlifting Women's Nationals in Miami. But that's not all that makes Faith remarkable. From partner station KUOW, Jeannie Yandel explains.
Faith Ireland's used to being a pioneer. In 1999, she was one of the first women on the Washington State Supreme Court. Before that, she was one of the first female superior court judges for King County. That's the county Seattle's in. Today, she's a different kind of trailblazer.
Up, 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 up. Come on, hips through, shoulders back. Nice.
How much did you lift just then?
That was 275.
A 275-pound barbell. Faith just lifted it off the ground, up to her hips, and back down again. That's called a deadlift.
That is the American record for women my age and eight. Wait, I hold the American record, and I'm hoping to beat it in my next meet.
Faith is 66, about 5'3", and 135 pounds. She looks healthy, but not overly muscular and veiny like you might expect.
If I'm hitting a personal best or something like that, you'll hear me squeaking, you know, jumping around, screaming.
Faith literally discovered powerlifting by accident.
I was in a car wreck in 1983, and I spent about 15 years kind of in agony with my back. And then I actually had a juror talk about lifting weights to overcome a back injury when he was talking with the lawyers about his own back injury.
Faith had tried lifting weights for her back before, but she was so inspired by what the juror said, she was determined to try again. She found a new trainer, a guy named Willie Austin. He was a powerlifting coach, so Faith wanted him to push her to lift through her pain. Faith was 55 and in her first year on the Supreme Court when she started training with Willie. She was also 30 pounds overweight.
Willie was a person who had gotten me out of pain and strong and starting to lose weight. So I pretty much would do anything he told me to do.
What Willie told Faith to do was compete in a local powerlifting match. She didn't win, but she found she loved challenging her body that way. She entered women's nationals and lost again. But the experience galvanized her to get ready for next time.
Why did you want to be ready? After an experience like that, I could imagine walking away thinking, well, that was interesting, but it's too hard. I'm not going to do that.
I've never been a quitter. Usually when I start something, I stick with it.
Sticking with it meant practicing three moves.
Let's go. Come on, baby.
The deadlift, or pull, is what Faith was doing in the beginning of the story. There's also the squat, where you hold a barbell above your shoulders and slowly bend your knees till your thighs are parallel to the ground. And then you stand back up. Then there's the bench press, or the push.
Go, girl. Come on.
That's probably the most well-known of the powerlifting moves. You lie on your back on a bench and push a barbell up from your chest and back down. Everyone in Faith's gym stops what they're doing to cheer on another lifter during a tough push or pull. The place almost feels like a secret clubhouse. The gym's in the basement of an office building in downtown Seattle. It's not visible from the street, and you can't get in unless someone lets you in. Faith is an elite member of this club. So is her teammate, Natalie Harmon. Natalie looks like Justine Bateman, if Justine Bateman could deadlift 330 pounds. She has a method for getting pumped up for tough deadlifts.
I get a little kick off of smack. If I'm really pushing, you'll see me smack my face even. I'll often leave here with a handprint on my leg.
Sometimes the person who smacks Natalie is the women's masters coach, Todd Christensen. He's been a powerlifting coach for 25 years. and he first met Faith when she needed help putting on a bench shirt. That's a tight shirt powerlifters wear for support during the bench press. He was pulling it over her head, and his hand slipped.
And the first thing I do is accidentally smack her upside the head, and I thought, oh, that's great. That's my introduction to the Supreme Court justices. And she turned to me and she said, look, Todd, I'm tough. I'm not a... Are you going to edit this?
Todd then uses a word for wimp that we can't say on the radio.
I'm like, well, that was a good introduction, and you know what? You're my kind of gal.
Todd's coaching made Faith more than a stronger power lifter. The physical discipline and the concentration the sport requires made her a more focused justice. In 2005, after 6 years on the Supreme Court, Faith decided to step down. Justices are elected here in Washington State, and Faith did not want to go through another campaign. She says she doesn't miss being a judge, but she misses her colleagues at the Supreme Court. She's okay with that, though. These days, her fellow powerlifters are her colleagues.
We get together at holidays. We sometimes get in tiffs. You get irritations going, but there is a closeness. This is my most immediate peer group now, even beyond lawyers and judges. So it's like a family.
In Seattle, I'm Jeannie Yandel for Weekend America.
Something that we've tried to do on this show over the years is cover sports from a different perspective than, say, ESPN would, or anyone would. For football, for instance, we've done stories on the long snapper, the guy whose only job it is to hike the ball in punting or kicking situations. We've also talked to the last two Mr. Irrelevants, guys who were picked dead last in the NFL draft. So as the Super Bowl is played this weekend, we're not going to talk about the Steelers, the team rich in tradition and favored to win. No, we're talking Arizona Cardinals, a team that no sane person would have ever predicted would be playing in this game. Will Leach is the founding editor of the sports website Deadspin.com. He writes for New York Magazine and is a lifelong, unapologetic Arizona Cardinals fan. Will Leach, hello.
Hello. Wow, you've really summed up just how miserable, even in the tone, how miserable it actually is to be an Arizona Cardinals fan. You have no idea.
Well, give us the nutshell version of Cardinals history. How bad have the Cardinals historically been?
Well, you know, they have been bad, but they haven't been bad in like a lovable way, like the Chicago Cubs, or even like to a lesser extent the Detroit Lions. They've really just been irrelevantly bad. One of my two favorite anecdotes, probably the best way to describe what it's mean to be an Arizona Cardinal fan. The first was they drafted a quarterback named Kelly Stauffer in 1987, who decided that he did not want to play for the Arizona Cardinals and decided to sit out a year, which you know people do this. Eli Manning did this with the Chargers and John Elway did this, but they are Eli Manning and John Elway. This is Kelly Stauffer. We got an Elway Manning pulled on us by Kelly Stauffer, who was so desperate, who probably shouldn't have been in the NFL anyway, and still he was like, well, if I'm going to play in the NFL, I'm not playing for the Arizona Cardinals.
He would postpone his career and not get paid rather than play for the Arizona Cardinals.
Yes, which is, as a fan, you know, makes sense. But when you're getting paid a lot of money, you really have to. I appreciate Stauffer standing behind his principles. But I really think the worst moment, definitely the nadir with the entire time, was about 5, 6, 7 years ago. The San Diego Chargers were supposed to play a Monday Night Football game against the Miami Dolphins. And that was when there were the fires in San Diego. And they thought there was a public safety issue. And they couldn't play it there. So they moved the game to Sun Devil Stadium, which is where the Cardinals were playing in Tempe at the time. And for the first time in about 5 or 6 years, it was a sellout at Sun Devil Stadium between the Chargers and the Dolphins. And you saw people in the stands with signs that says ABC, anybody but Cardinals. Like, finally, we get to watch some football. We finally got a sellout when neither one of the teams were the Cardinals. I always feel like that's a pretty good example of the relief and gratitude that Arizona sports fans had to watch a team other than Arizona in their hometown.
When your fandom has been defined by mediocrity, does success, as in your team in the Super Bowl, provoke an existential crisis in you? Do you even know who you are anymore?
It's certainly strange. You know, it's funny. No matter what happens on Sunday, And obviously, I'll be rooting for the Cardinals to win. But whatever happens, a certain part of the battle almost feels a little bit over with already. The idea that, you know, in 50 years, there will be proof when they have Super Bowl. I'm assuming it will just be a string of X's at that point. I think that's as far
just
as it goes.
Random X's. Just
random X's. No one can keep track anymore anyway. But in 50 years, they will look back and there will be proof that the Arizona Cardinals existed. They were in the Super Bowl. And it doesn't seem real yet.
We don't live in Phoenix. And we don't live in Pittsburgh. We don't, you know, live in any of these places, but we like to watch the Super Bowl. Why should people root for the Arizona Cardinals?
Well, if the Steelers win this Super Bowl, it'll be their 6th overall, Ben Roethlisberger's 2nd. It'll just be another Steelers Super Bowl win. But if the Arizona Cardinals win this game, it'll be something that people will never forget, even if they try really, really hard.
Even after years of therapy.
Yeah, exactly.
Will Leach, journalist and lifelong Arizona Cardinals fan/apologist, thank you so much.
Of course. Thank you for having me, and go Cardinals.
Weather forecast for the Super Bowl in Tampa, Florida, sunny and 69 degrees, winds out of the southeast at 9 miles per hour. Man, forget football. I just want to go hang out. If you can't make it down there to Tampa, you can still have fun this weekend. Here's Jeannie Yandel.
Even though there isn't a fancy, some word in Latin phobia type name for it, many people have a fear of kites. If you're one of them, stay away from South Padre Island, Texas during Kite Fest. There'll be kite demos and kite flying lessons, 69 and hopefully windy. So for people who don't fear kites, this could just be a nice day where you hope a novice kite flyer doesn't hit you in the head. One might assume the best way to run a race is quickly, but in the case of Bloomsburg, Pennsylvania's turtle races, one would be wrong about the quickness. 26 and sunny to watch turtles move extremely slowly towards the finish line. Bring a book, you got time. In fact, come back next weekend. It's supposed to be warmer and those turtles will still be racing. In ancient Egypt, the pharaohs would often relax with a snow slalom race. Durango, Colorado says, whatever, we know we're historically inaccurate. We're dressing up like ancient Egyptians anyway during snowdown in denial. Insert joke about denying something here. 49 and sunny for chili cook-off and cat fashion shows. I guess the pharaohs were pretty into cats. Well done, Durango. For more information on these and other events, go to weekendamerica.org. With a little bit of weather everywhere, I'm Jeannie Yandel for Weekend America.
The future of entertainment? It involves robots. Why? Because everything in the future always involves robots. That's why. I hope they're friendly robots. They're never friendly robots. Next on Weekend America.
American Public Media would like to thank Target for its generous support of Weekend America and the communities we have served together from the first show to the last.
From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe.
The long-form story was dying.
I went to see Indiana Jones, and the whole row of kids were all texting each other. I said, My God, things have changed.
Who would rescue the story?
It's those who create the kinds of new technologies that might destroy it, that can also preserve it.
The mad genius.
I've been called worse.
The director of MIT's Media Lab.
I love popcorn.
The filmmaker I called up to get a different perspective.
It's not like we're going to create robots and then make them president.
The future of storytelling.
That's reporter Sean Cole. This is movie awards season, and we asked Sean to look into a story about MIT teaming up with a new movie studio in Massachusetts to create the storytelling technology of the future. But instead of doing a radio report about it, Sean wrote a sci-fi movie-type drama and cast himself as the character of the reporter. Sean's like that. So grab some popcorn.
My whole life is about the story. When I'm not working, I like to work. And when I'm not doing that, I like to kick back with a book and a dame, in that order. So when I heard that the mad genius was coming up with newfangled ways of telling stories, I got the wiggles. His real name's David Kirkpatrick. I found him holed up in an old factory in Plymouth, Mass. His office was all decked out with inspirational quotes on the walls. J.D. Salinger, Joni Mitchell, and a New York Times headline from an article about him.
It's a once-feared kingmaker called to a different battle. Because I was in Hollywood for a number of years, I ran a couple of studios, Walt Disney, Touchstone, Paramount Pictures. So that's a kingmaker.
Now he's got a new project. Plymouth Rock Studios, also known as Hollywood East. They're supposed to open a huge new movie and TV campus down the road in 2010, also known as the future.
And the future will have picture palaces that will be 3D or 5D, including holograms, including what we'll laughingly call back in the 60s, smell-o-vision. It will be a complete immersive experience.
So it won't be just like looking at a wall with moving pictures on it.
It'll be on your lap. It'll be kissing you and touching you. That's where we're headed.
Why do we need that?
I don't know that we need it. It's what we want.
But there was more to Kirkpatrick's plans than met the eye. And one way or the other, I was going to get at the truth.
Where are you hiding the robots?
The robots are being hidden right now in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Well, that was very forthcoming of you. I was expecting you to be a lot more devious about it.
Now play some woo-woo music under it. You know, this is what we used to call it at Paramount, the woo-woo music. You know, the stuff that like, uh-oh, there's going to be a plot twist now.
Okay, I'm at the MIT Media Lab in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
I had started to put the pieces together. Plymouth Rock Studios was financing a new center at the MIT Media Lab, the Center for Future Storytelling. It was going to build a lot of the tricked-out razzmatazz the mad genius had told me about. One of the PR people showed me the robots. There was an eerily expressive one with eyebrows. They even had a robotic teddy bear in the works.
So you'll actually cuddle this teddy bear?
Yeah.
The teddy bear might be a way in which a grandparent can communicate and convey to a grandchild across the world a story about their family or history.
Frank Moss is the head honcho of the Media Lab, and listening to his rap, I realized that storytelling meant more than just Hollywood entertainment. The teddy bear might be used for story time. Then he floated the idea of a robot walking into your living room and playing out a drama in which you're one of the characters.
It could be a very mischievous player that might constantly be looking to spread confusion and chaos within the story.
I knew robots were devious.
But robots can be romantic. These robots may actually be better at reading our feelings, reading our faces, and understanding us than even an actor would be.
Nothing against actors. Moss loves cinema, but he knows he's a dying breed. Bite-sized media has taken over entertainment, what the mad genius would call snack culture. And then I had a dramatic epiphany. These guys weren't trying to kill long-form storytelling. They were trying to save it. I ran back to Kirkpatrick's office for our dramatic epiphany scene.
So as opposed to trying to fight snack culture with old-timey ways of telling stories, it's like, no, this is what people are like now. We need to figure out a way to ease them into our long stories.
Precisely. Absolutely precisely. You're one of the first men to get it. The mad scientist in the tower applauds you.
There was just one question left to answer.
Who is Joe Swanberg?
I don't know. Who is he?
I'm a filmmaker from Chicago, and I guess also a web video maker.
I called up Swanberg because I always thought he was the future of storytelling. He's 27, makes low-tech, no-budget movies and web shows with his actor friends improvising the dialogue.
And I'm saying, we already have everything we need. We have books. What else do you want? Jeez, if you don't like that, we have movies. Relax.
Swanberg thinks a lot about how technology can actually inhibit human interaction. In 2005, he made a movie called LOL, about tech-savvy guys that have trouble relating to women, even when those women are their girlfriends.
Hey, which do you think we'll have first, a black president or a robot president?
It's a little dated now, but it's also prescient. In the age of YouTube and Facebook, Swanberg says, people are less interested in long-form stories because they're more interested in themselves.
That is the true threat to the movie-going experience. It's not self-centered enough. When I look at the future landscape of movies, what I see is not one movie that everybody goes to see. I see each person having their own movie that nobody goes to see.
Maybe. But the mad genius says c'est la vie. If that's where we're headed, let's embrace it, as long as the story survives.
And that is at the heart, and I mean the heart, of the Center for Future Storytelling, because no science fiction gets done without it touching a human heart, a human emotion, a sense of fear, a wonder, of exploration. It's all driven by who and what makes you unique as a human being.
So stay tuned, folks. There's bound to be a sequel to this story. And who knows, maybe there'll be a part for you in it. In Boston, I'm Sean Cole for Weekend America.
And that's it for one of the last hours of American Public Media's Weekend America. If you want, you can still subscribe to our Twitter feed, twitter.com/theweekend. I'll try to update you there on where some of the voices on this show are going next, what I'm doing next, other people too. You can download a free podcast of the program at weekendamerica.org. That's where you can also find literally thousands of stories that we've done over the years. You can search by reporter or producer. I hope you keep in touch. I'm John Moe. Thanks for listening.
Weekend America is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. This program is made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul, and made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by
American Public Media.